Welcome to Catching Up with Comedians. I'm your host, Rich Stein.
Welcoming you here, Slade Ham, all the way from Houston, Texas. Ladies and gentlemen, Slade Ham, welcome to the show, Catching Up with Comedians. Slade Ham.
Hey. I'm here.
Is that the old?
I like to hide behind the curtain and make the MC sweat. Oh, man, am I going to have to do another 10? Hey, what do you do for a living?
Anyway, what else is going on? You know, that line. I love that line. What else is going on?
Yeah. You're supposed to tell us, buddy. That's what we paid for. Right. Hello. We good?
Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear. So I remember I kind of knew you before I met you because I went to watch I Am Battle Comic in Redondo Beach, I think it was. I don't think you were there.
Oh, yeah. I was at the screening in Long Beach, maybe.
Oh, okay. Wow.
I got to go back and remember. It was me and Pescatelli and Jordan and a bunch of people there. Yeah.
Wow. You're dropping the names. I like Tammy. I follow her. I love a good, any great Italian comic, and they're all great as far as I can say.
She's such a, me and her are just friends. Oh, yeah. I like her
She's
a lot.
She's great. So I saw it in Redondo Beach, and Jordan, of course, was there, and Don Barnhart, Jeff Capri, and it was, you know, because I had seen I Am Comic and I Am Road Comic, so that, I guess it's the trilogy, and known Jordan. Hopefully he'll do more, but that's...
That's the third in the trilogy, and the thing is, I didn't know what we were making when I said yes to the tour. Don Barnhart's an old friend of mine. We go all the way back to probably the year 2000 or something.
He's the hardest working man in showbiz.
He is. I have never seen him without a hammer in his hand. That dude is always working on something. So we've done a few tours before, and he called me up and invited me out on this one, and I naturally said yes. He goes, we're going to tape some of this stuff. Yeah. And I went, cool. Uh-huh. And I just thought this would be some knucklehead opener with a video camera or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, and Don would put it together, and it would be fine and beautiful and everything. But I didn't know it was Jordan Brady.
Right.
And when I found out, I went, wait, like, I am com-. And then the whole thing came together, and I was like, wait, am I going out? Am I on? Am I in the third documentary? Yeah. Like, I was enrolled and on my way overseas before I knew what I was even into. And then, you know, the rest is, when I saw the finished film, you're just like, oh God, this guy's a genius.
Right. He really, I first worked with him, and I remember being in the San Diego Improv 1989, you know, laugh competition. But I always kind of knew him because we'd worked the same. We did UC Santa Barbara once, and once he started making films, you know, and he made a film with Billy Bob Thornton and Charlize Theron and went through all that stuff. But he was always the prodigy of the group of comics I grew up. I mean, he was already on the A-list, you know, one of those old specials, and he was like 27 years old, you know.
I recall the old stand-up from Jordan on '80s Evening.
It was great.
The old shows. He's you're known as the guy who invented the bounty.
Exactly.
Wow, wow.
And he really
did. That was his old stick. And so for me, to see him out on this tour, he was hosting these shows.
Right.
And it was so cool to see those old muscles creep back awake. And to watch him really, you know, he's a filmmaker now.
Exactly.
And to capture something like, that film follows us through Bahrain, Kuwait, and Afghanistan.
Oh, my God.
And
it's a great film.
Just,
it's a great film, just what you guys had to endure and go through, and him filming it on that little, his little handy cam.
He shot the whole thing so subtly. You did not know a film was being made.
Exactly.
And when I watch it back, it's astounding. And it's just a testament to him and knowing where to shoot and what to shoot and how to shoot it and then how to put all that together. And it's really a magic film. It's on Hulu right now. I think you can watch it for free.
Yeah. I like how I always read the credits because an I Am Battle comic on your IMDb page, this is a true road warrior. You're listed in credits as self, which means you were the comic in it. Battle comic, additional camera. That's the greatest. Only someone like me would notice that. I mean, man, you were like gaffing and prepping and
We were, well, there were a lot of scenes. If you watch the film, there's scenes that Jordan's in.
Sure.
And at some point you got to hand the camera off.
But that's the way it should be. That's such classic comedians making a film, but.
Well, Jordan taught me, we bring him up. It's mm-hmm. as a mentor.
Oh, yeah.
Jordan Brady, as a filmmaker, a mm-hmm. lot of what has happened for me in the last 4 or 5 years with mm-hmm. the comedy specials and some of the stuff we'll get into mm-hmm. is purely inspired by him and mm-hmm. what I've seen, the way I've seen him tell stories about mm-hmm. stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the I Am Comic, because, Rich Scheidner was the classic case of, one of the great. He was one of those comics that's a great live comic. And just, he was another one. For a long time, he said, well, why am I, why am I retired doing my father's insurance business? But as you well know, I'm sure because you hung out with him, it was Jordan, I think, that kicked his ass back into yep. comedy. That movie.
Yep. And that's the, when you look at somebody like Rich, I mm-hmm. think there's a ton of comics out there. Yeah. We're really good at our craft and we're good at our arts and mm-hmm. we're all of that stuff. But a filmmaker, somebody like Jordan can take someone like us right. and sort of knock off the rough edges and distill it down to the story. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you're able to see somebody like Rich who's great and funny and mm-hmm. wonderful and accomplished, mm-hmm. but in a very narrow light, you're like, oh, mm-hmm. that's cool. That's like yeah. the essence of yeah. someone. It's concentrate. It's mm-hmm. very neat to see a filmmaker work with comedy mm-hmm. that way.
And that was kind of, it was very skeletal, the I Am Comic, the original. It was very bare bones because he allowed himself to be seen, kind of warts and all, going up at those mm-hmm. some of those dive bars and like Van Nuys and shit. And just, he was still funny. He goes, look at this. Mm-hmm. They got the TV on. The pool table's playing over here.
Uh-huh. Everything very, very honest and authentic and, something that you'd be like, oh, that should be below him. But to tell that story in a way mm-hmm. that makes sense and to rearrange the parts and to mm-hmm. shine the light on the certain scenes and go, look, mm-hmm. this is how you get from here to here. Yeah. That film is just so artfully done. Yeah. I sound like I'm gushing over it, but it's really well done.
Amen. Like Nikki Glaser at the time was a middle act. And I think she was in San Diego. She was waiting for a little of the wacky tobacco to be delivered by the opening act. And she had no makeup on. And look, mm-hmm. look at how far she's come from that. I mean, but she always had mm-hmm. the bones. She always had the bones of a great comic, but she was, I think in some way that, most people, I didn't, until I watched it the second time, I didn't even click that that's who that even was, in that scene.
Yeah. They might've shot her in, that was a Hammer comic, but it's something like films like that mm-hmm. gives, it's just a stamp of credibility, right? It's the mm-hmm. patch on the jacket. You're in that, you are a comic. It's literally in the title. And that's a, mm-hmm. People could argue about, you're a comic, you're not a comic. There's a lot of that today.
Right.
But when that film came out and you were in it, you're a comic.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, not to gush over Brady too much, but he, his wife's a filmmaker. He was his two kids, which he's been so, and he's such a great family man and stuff. Both of his sons, Jake and I can't even remember the name of his other boy, Jake, but Ben, mm-hmm. he's, they're following in his footsteps. So he's got a whole family of videographers and filmmakers, and he's so supportive of guys like the guy he works with all the time, Pat. He's a Midwestern guy. He's an actor. He has him in a lot of his commercials and stuff. Good Irish boy, Pat.
Jordan's built good families.
Yeah, he's so great. So great. All right, so let's talk about Signal Noise, which is your basically film documentary, isn't that the one that you... Didn't you shoot that like a year ago in Houston? That's when you shot it, right?
So we shot Signal Noise comes mm-hmm. out April 2nd. It's the new special. And
on
we
YouTube.
Shot it in and intentionally on YouTube. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that in a second. Yeah. But we shot it in August of last year.
Right.
And we started fundraising it in May. We shot in August, and then the process of finishing a film can just, if you've really got it together and you got big Hollywood money and this mm-hmm. all goes to a post-production house and they mm-hmm. send it back to you in a week and you send your edits back and that's lovely. But mm-hmm. there's also reality.
Yeah, right.
Which is, we're making this. Mm-hmm. If we're making this, mainly I'm making this.
Sure.
So you know, you go through the process of finishing the film and you got to get it right. And you want to, you know, you're trying to do some things to make it stand out. Mm-hmm. And we took some time with it. And there's, you know, now it's coming out and it's, I couldn't be more happy with the additional time it took.
That's great. It's worth it. Yeah. Yeah. You should, I have to say, I've, you know, I know a lot of comics, like, you know, over the years, and, you know, with, I have to say that I've been really impressed with what I've seen, because I saw your stand up in Vegas and I've seen you in I Am Battle Comic, but you're one of those guys that my pal Jazz Kaner calls. Yeah, he's a seeker. He's a seeker. You're going beyond the fray. You're going above and beyond the, you know, the, what the normal path is for a comedian. And we can talk about that a little more later, but I always,
certainly,
I always said I booked a bunch of rooms in my career, and I always said, and you've booked rooms when you're starting out. I always said every comic, working comic, should book a room at least once in his career. More, but at least once. And then they wouldn't be showing up late, hitting on the bar staff, ordering food without introducing themselves. And my favorite, dropping the mic, because it's in their act. Dropping that $250 Shure mic on the wood stage, because, yeah, no, that's in my act. I can't take that.
I used to appreciate Rick Gutierrez, who would show up when he played my club, Rick, little bulldog, and he'd come in and he would unzip this little Shure microphone case,
there you go.
And he would pull out this beat up Dented Shure 57.
Wow.
You're gonna want to use this. I hit myself with it a lot. You don't want me to break your microphone, homie. He goes, so just do it with mine.
And
it was so nice. I just plugged him right in, and he beat himself up with the microphone all night, and none of my stuff got broken. And I found that away. I was like, man, that's if I ever have to hit myself with a mic.
And he had all that those Shure 57s, because all the musicians use those. The cage around the mic has always got a million dents in it, but they're flawless. Yeah, a lot of the old comics like O'Brien and Valdez that did impressions, and Jim O'Brien used to have to eat his mic when he was doing his impression. They always carried their own mic because they said, I ain't putting that standard mic that everybody sneezes on up into my mouth. So that was smart.
They
bought their own mic.
The one I use in the special is a red and white Shure 57. And
nice.
I got it at the beginning of the pandemic because we started to go back on the road, I was, you know, I'll take some chances, but we're not going to share a microphone in a pandemic. I'll just bring my own. So I did that. And then, you know, ever since then, it's nice. I've got it. I just bring it. It's so much simpler.
Yeah, because, you know, you can't put a blue surgical mask over a microphone. Although I'm sure some comics do.
They were doing those little mic condoms for a while. Anyway.
All right. So anything else you want to kind of say? I just wanted to give a good send off, and we'll plug it again at the end. But Signal Noise.
I think when you watch it, the intention behind it was to, and this sort of leads into the philosophy behind the stuff we were talking about a second ago. I know what the landscape looks like right now.
Sure.
I know what stand-up comedy inside of quotation marks looks like on the internet. Mm-hmm. And I also know that I'm personally do something different.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not doing 45 second jokes. There's a 7-minute story on here. There's a 9-minute story on here. It's something different. We did it with scale, and we did it with color, and we did it with intent. Scarface and the Ghetto Boys introduces me. There's music from Candlebox in the end credits. Like, we shot a short film that's about 60 seconds up front. And it's a bunch of filmmakers and musicians and comics really kind of flexing. And it's, I think, if you watch it, you're going to go, oh, wow, yeah, this is I want more of this.
Yeah.
So that's my plug for the show.
That's great, because, you know, not back, but I had Tommy Moore in my first couple of podcasts, and he was talking about when he first had Shecky Green in 57, they sent Elvis, and Elvis was going to headline. Well, here's the ultimate slam on Elvis, you know, because Colonel Tom was out in the parking lot with a gun trying to get people. Always the carny. He was trying to get people, but everybody knew Shecky, so You've heard a million times. I remember, you know, a million times the middle has to switch with a headliner because he couldn't hold the room. That's a badge of honor with most comics. But you imagine that Shecky Green, he goes, Shecky Green said, I was known in Vegas. I was a commodity. And in those days, he goes, teenagers didn't come to Vegas. He had blue suede shoes and hound dog. And so here's the ultimate slam for Elvis. The second night, Elvis was opening, Shecky was closing. can you imagine that? And they said, and so he's sitting out in the audience with Bing Crosby. This is Tommy Moore telling the story. I never heard that. And with Bing Crosby, and he said, this kid, he's a nice kid. He sings okay, but I don't know. I don't see. And Bing Crosby says, this is an homage to your special. He says, he's going to be the biggest thing in the world someday. And Shecky Green says, how come he's different? Because he's different.
Wow. Huh?
That's coming from Der Bingle, who wasn't that great with his first set of kids he had, but he knew showbiz, Der Bingle.
That is the hope. Mm. And I think that's what we're all hoping to be. We'll see.
And storytelling is really the lost art of comedy, and I always have a sign. A lot of my friends got into the storyteller game. I said, yeah, that's comedy for people that ain't funny. Bah! So I'm a storyteller. Oh, you're very 20 minutes of this.
I think back to the guys that were the best storytellers.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. I watched growing up. The Ron Shocks. You know,
I'm just talking about the guys that do storytelling, at the Moth. And there's a lot of good ones, but there's a lot. Believe me, I heard one lady do a 20-minute story about how she had to wait for the moving van in her driveway for 20 minutes. I said, this isn't a story. This is a complaint on a phone to an in-law. You know, this ain't a story. I'm in agreement.
There's a lot of stuff inside of the circle of people talking doesn't fall inside of the circle of stand-up comedy. Moth and TED Talks and half a TikTok now. Stand-up's a very specific muscle, and if you're going to be a storyteller, it has to be a series of jokes. It has to be set up, punch, that just all happen to be in a row. And if you're not doing that, then you need to take your ass to the Moth.
No, some of the greatest comics of all time, Flip Wilson, Lenny Bruce, storytellers. You know, they're storytellers, and I theoretically am not one. I kind of wish I were, because I think it's a much more laudable trait. But you know, like, and that's what Tommy Moore said about Shecky Green, how he wasn't just a take my wife, please, ladies and germs guy. He would come out and do a whole 20 minutes on an opera, just ad libbing it and stuff. So I'm looking forward to seeing your special, and that's why I've been impressed with you, because the more stuff I've watched of you, I did a little homework knowing you were coming on, and when I watch stuff when you're on the local shows in Texas and when you're on different podcasts, I can tell you're well-read, and at your age, I didn't get my book out until I was a lot older than you, and I was sitting on it for a long time, but at your age, to be coming out with a second book, and I don't think I even mentioned either, your celebrity precedes you, because 60 countries and 6 continents, and that's at the last gig you had. Did you get more than 60? You probably got a few more than 60 countries.
No, 60, that stays pretty. That's the one part of the internet that stays constantly updated. I think my country count, if you pull it off of my website, I can't speak for the rest of the internet and how fast it disseminates info, but that's the one I keep current, man. Wow. I'll update that on the plane on the ride back home.
But just 66 has great alliteration to it, and it's just a nice,
doesn't it?
It's a nice number. I mean,
it's a little evil.
You know, I made it to Australia and New Zealand with the wife and kid, and I'm pretty, even some of my friends, when I show pictures of me on the, in front of the Sydney Opera House and stuff. Hey, did you ever make it to Tasmania? There's a cool little kangaroo, Bonorongo Kangaroo Ranch. That was my badge of honor. I made it to Tasmania, and we fed the kangaroos. So that's not 60 countries, but that was a pretty cool little place.
aren't kangaroos monsters?
Oh, like, God, you think,
till you get up next to one and realize, oh my God, this thing could knock my head across the outback.
Yeah.
And then I ate one and I realized how delicious the tail meat is. And I was like, you know what, man, this might be worth the fight.
Yeah. I know. I always look down at those nails on their bottom, on their pushing, jumping feet. I look at them nails. I go, Lord, they give you these little nuggets to feed them. They just don't claw my eyeballs out with them nails on them bottom feet, brother.
Right, because they can lay back on their tail and then put their feet up and kick you like that dude who beat Anakin in the podcast race. Like it's just a.
Right. I've seen the YouTube. That's one of my my daughter always says, get off the reels. that's kind of an addiction, getting on the reels. All right, so Signal Noise comes out April 2 and YouTube, and I was watching your other thing too there, and you made some really valid points about, you know, how Dry Bar is great for a guy like Bob Zaney, gets a couple million hits, Brad Upton gets millions of hits. But I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit that about the business. You're savvy to the business of comedy because you'll never see any money on that Dry Bar special other than what your stipend was for making it. So that's where you're trying to kind of circumvent that with the way you do your specials, right?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself a couple of questions if you're in stand-up right now, right? Mm-hmm. One, what is it you want?
Mm-hmm.
It being the big one. And that's a multi-pronged question because we got to ask ourselves what we want professionally.
Yeah.
But we also got to ask ourselves, especially when you get to my age and at this point mm-hmm. in my career where mm-hmm. I've been doing this damn near a quarter of a century.
Right.
So it's not like I'm not here trying to prove to myself I can make it.
Right.
Make it has changed drastically mm-hmm. from what this young kid in the early 2000s thought.
Right.
When we all go, I'm going to be the first guy with the HBO Showtime special in 2 years, and I'm going to host SNL, and then mm-hmm. I'm going to host the Oscars. We just go into comedy thinking we're mm-hmm. going to get all this.
Sure.
And later on, once you've done a great many things, right. hopefully you've tried some stuff, you've mm-hmm. traveled, you've written, you've performed, you've hosted, you've done sketch, you've done all of this stuff,
right.
you've played. Then you sit down and you go, well, shit, what do I really enjoy? Mm-hmm. What of that do I want to go back to? Because mm-hmm. being on a stand-up stage while a special's being filmed, conceptualizing it, spending the way I've spent my last 3 years making some great things
mm-hmm.
has felt wonderful. Sleeping on the couch or walking across those dirty floors at a condo in Tucson, you know, for a dollar amount that doesn't have a comma in it. And you just go, well, I'm not really interested in that anymore. When I backwards engineer my life from what I want it to be, how do I want to spend my days? What mm-hmm. do I want to focus on? What do I want to build? It leads me back to where I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And making things the way I'm making them now. If you start with Jerry Wayne Longmire,
right.
who is – he's having some amazing success online right now.
The Wrecking Yard, 2021.
Yeah.
I got the IMDb P. The Wrecking – first of all, any guy with three names who's from Texas – I'm hopping on board.
That's a mouthful of hillbilly right
there. And the Wrecking Yard. Not wrecking. I reckon so.
I reckon it is. We shot that. Jerry was going to make this special, and right. I was interested in learning to make specials at the same time. It was a very good collision.
Sure.
And I sort of interjected myself and I me and the guy, some of the film guys I was working with, we all just kind of jumped in with what mm-hmm. Jerry had, which was at the time, he had, I think, like three Blackmagic cameras, and we just kind of, we made it work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we shot a really cool intro. And then I was very careful. I was using it as a place to learn the editing and there was so many parts of it that when it was done, it's really magnificent for what we were shooting. In fact, as mm-hmm. a club shoot, as a three camera club shoot, which is what it is. It's not just as good. It's mm-hmm. better than anything else that's really out there right now in that same sort of bracket.
Cool.
And that was a bit of a realization that I could take some of these tools, right?
Mm.
I know how to film stuff. I'm shooting some mm-hmm. stuff. Jordan's inspired me. I've been filming some travelogues. I've been trying to learn to edit.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the first time I was able to like direct the laser at stand-up comedy and go, okay, how do I put these powers to use for good? I've been practicing. Let's make this.
That's great.
And then you make that. And a year later, someone like Andy Huggins, an old legend, Andy, asked the question online. How would I tape my act if I wanted to? That was the question. And he posted it in a public Houston group. And you saw two or three responses. Right. Well, you could get three cell phones. You need to talk to so-and-so. Right. Well, so-and-so's got you just look at it all. You go, this is not how Andy's one of the old original Texas Outlaw comics. Right. He's been doing stand-up.
I saw the Bill Hicks special, the 2009 Bill Hicks special. Mm-hmm. But I already know who he was, but I haven't texted him. Hey, you come up in that. And that was kind of a good one. Like, there's another Sam Kinison special that came out in the early 2000s, which is actually really good. He uses a lot of Comedy Store comic. But Bill Hicks, his mother, all his family were in there. And that one guy who has a name like yours, but it's Dwight Slade, not Slade.
Yes. Man. Dwight Slade. Dwight and I used to sign our emails back and forth to each other. TOS, the other Slade. Nah. That was how we signed him. So Andy, as legendary as he was, I remember seeing those comments and thinking to myself, that can't be the answer, right? Like, I don't know the answer, but that certainly can't be it. And I stopped and I went, okay, what do I know? Right.
Now, did you know him at that point to talk to him?
Oh, Andy and I have been friends for 20 plus years. That's great. So
I like the younger comics who are, like, when I started going out again, when I retired from teaching in like 2013, I was always saying, really? I wrote a book and I was on the road for you and you're not asking me to be on your podcast, you know, but that's, that's the different generation, you know? So that's cool that you saw the, because obviously he did what a lot of comics did. He went out to L.A. and then he figured out, this place ain't for me. So, all right, so go ahead. So you knew him for 20 years.
Yeah, so I looked at that and I went, all right. Mm-hmm. So I know how to make this. We did this thing for Jerry. I understand the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. I also did. We did the Whiskey Brothers comedy.
Right, I saw that.
2015, and it's another thing that I feel like. And I say all of this, I don't say any of this, I'll probably repeat this, but I don't say any of this bitterly. I say all of this with a smirk and a smile and kind of a playful twinkle in my eye.
Right.
But with what we did in 2015, we were also too early in a weird way.
Wow.
And not just because of the state of the business that wasn't quite ready for what guys like Mark Norman and Joe List and CK were doing with self-release specials.
Uh-huh.
It was too early for me.
Okay.
I didn't know what to do with what we made.
All right.
I didn't have the connections or the contacts or the I didn't have a place to take it.
Okay.
So we shot this wonderful special with four stand-up comics, and we closed it out with Scarface. We all did It Feels Good to Be a Gangster together. We made a fun film, and we couldn't sell it. But what I learned through the process was we crowdfunded it, and I used Whiskey Brothers podcast fans to raise the money. And then we went out and found a few producers, people who wanted to put some bigger dollars in. It caused me to go out and learn this. So I took these two things I'd done.
Right.
I'd made these two specials. I'd raised the money once, and I called Andy, and I go, let's talk, man, because I know how much the local Houston community loves him. And I was like, if I can raise money – and nobody knows me. This adorable old man, we got this. And we put a plan together and we raised the money and we spent it all. And we made what I think was an even cooler film than we thought was possible.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Comedy Dynamics ended up picking it up. And I'm going to bring all this back around to the drive point.
Okay.
But this is the roadmap there. When we struck this deal, and, you know, I won't go into the specifics, but it involved advance money and, you know, the back end deal and all the good stuff you want. But it put the special behind a paywall. And it was this, you know, it comes out like a new release. People will buy it for $13 or what have you.
Right.
And that, when I looked at it, I took that and I went, okay, that's one model. Right. We put it behind a paywall. We try for some advance money. We hope people will buy it and see it and see what happens down the line.
Uh-huh.
There's also a way to get yourself out there by having someone else make this special for you. There are companies like Drybar, right, who are bringing you in, paying you X amount, promising you money on the back end. And then releasing your special, but they own everything. Hmm. It's like being booked at a comedy club for the weekend. You get your pay, and then they get everything else.
Right.
So there's also guys who are producing specials for guys who can put the money together for themselves, and there's a certain look, and they all the specials start the same. You start with the guy on stage. There's a joke he's telling. Then as soon as that punchline hits, you go to a quick intro, usually him walking to the club, or the people standing in line outside, or the camera following him to the stage. The title comes up, and then they play the rest of the special. It's very, very formulaic.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just have to ask yourself, like, what are you trying to create? That's the original question. What do I want? And what I want is the ability to visually conceptualize the whole thing, to write the material and know no one's going to sit there that doesn't know anything about comedy and chisel it up and make it something I don't want it to be, because I know how hard of an editor I'm going to be on myself. We shot an hour and 10 minutes. My special is 54 minutes long. Like there's there's a reason that you have to be in charge of the edit. You can't just relinquish this to some dude who doesn't know the act. I know when a joke didn't go the way I wanted it to. I know when it didn't belong in there.
Right.
And I know when it does. Mm-hmm. So when you look at all of that, it just seems like if you really want a career that has a body of work that you're proud of and is truly representative of you at the moment, then it makes sense to sit there, take the time, learn the guts and the nuts and the bolts of what it is you want to do, and then just fucking do it, man. It's
Right. Yeah, amen. Yeah, there's too many people just kind of sleepwalking through, you know, whatever the career they think, you know. In the old days, when you said, like you alluded to, in the old days you had to get Carson, well, you know one shot on Rogan will blow a shot on Carson out of the map, and then everybody did their evening at the Improvs or Caroline's comedy clubs and all that. But all that's out the back door now, you know. That's
well, there's always been a path to the top of the mountain, and it changes, you know. Rogan now is what Carson was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is, you still fundamentally have to have actual skill and talent and the ability for any of that to matter, because being on Rogan doesn't mean anything if when you show up in the club that he helped you fill up, you can't do the hour.
Exactly, right.
So that's just where I feel like if you rush and you're trying to clamber and hurriedly make something that fits the TikTok model or these short models, you're not really working on the craft, which is what you need to capitalize on all this other bullshit you keep doing.
What did Carlin do? He cranked out another hour special every 3 or 4 years. He did it the old-fashioned way. He worked his ass off at writing and streamlining and chiseling it down, like you say, you know.
Well, and if you look at why, it's back to this fundamental question of what do I want to do? Right. Because if this is a job for you, if you wake up and you're trying to figure out things to do and say to get people to click and trick and do all this stuff, then you're not necessarily doing what you're supposed to be doing. To me, I wake up and I wish to God I could turn off the machine in my head that slams ideas together to see how they connect. That is the most torturously ongoing perpetual motion machine I've ever seen. So I am interested in making specials and, and writing books and doing things, not just because, hey, look at me, look at me, look at me, but because if I don't, there's going to be such an internal logjam that I won't be able to sleep at night.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I've got that too. I don't know how, you know, I've been writing. I've got just yellow legal pads, just full and full from all my, and I've saved all my old stuff. And, you know, I've just constantly every day, I just get out the yellow legal pads because I have to, you know, I have to put it out. And that's why I started doing, that's kind of why I started doing this, because I'm no longer the young ingenue, you know. So I've always liked talking to comics, and I've always liked the process, and I've always liked being a student of comedy. So you, as a quick little segue here, you were my ideal guest because you're a kind of a young guy who's been doing it for 25 years, but you've got, you know, you've got a little different path you're taking, and you're very passionate about it. And that's, yeah, that's really neat. You know, you're taking a different path than most comics take, and that will eventually, you know, and you've paid your dues. You know, these specials that are up here on your IMDb page, they all came with a certain amount of blood, sweat, and tears, I'm sure, you know,
It feels good when you realize what you're supposed to be doing. It takes the pressure of the competition off. I don't feel like I'm fighting for the same bone as everyone else, which is this weird online currency of likes and shares. And I get the value of them. I understand the role they play, but it's also I feel like that comes along if I do the other part right and not necessarily the opposite.
I always said more people will read my book when I'm dead, and that's fine, you know, because I said I kind of left it all on the page there. I said a lot of my stuff that I wanted to say in the book, so that's cool. And I even told my daughter, read this book when you're 35. You'll get a kick out of it. I was going to ask you about all the what you just said is that you wouldn't have had the passion, or you wouldn't have been nearly as good in the Andy Huggins making that special if you hadn't have suffered a little bit with the Whiskey Brothers and the Wrecking Yard. Suffered in terms of learning your craft as you went. So thank God you did, though. So many people are afraid, and you see these memes all the time and these homilies all the time. Don't be afraid to fail. Yeah, you never learn anything from success. You learn more from failure, but it still doesn't make it any easier to have the failures, especially when you're a comic and you're on stage and stuff. I think you really proved your mettle by going to Whiskey Brothers. And when you did Huggins, and I mean, that's because he's just such a lovable guy. Let me ask you something real fast. Was Howie Mandel, when he went on, I'm going to go ahead and make a showbiz guess that Howie already knew he was coming on, and that wasn't, you know, because Howie's not that good of an actor. He said, hey, aren't you so-and-so?
I thought that myself, but Andy said that when Howie first passed him, he sincerely did not know.
Okay, well, I could see that.
So I, you know, to me, all of Hollywood's bullshit. So I just assumed that was...
Because it looks, hey, aren't you? Because like the other day I saw Loretta Lynn's granddaughter was on one of those voice shows. And she goes, oh, I'm Loretta Lynn's granddaughter. And they all said, oh, my God. Even the people that didn't know country music. But it looked a little staged, but...
It's all just a little can. But the Andy thing, I think, was legit. To your point, though, with these things, when it comes to failure, right, it's very cliche to say, you know, you learn from your failure, you get back up, and you blah, 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 whatever motivational poster you got to put on your office wall. Right.
Hang in there.
You know, the cat hanging from the – the truth is, when you – The Whiskey Brothers was almost a decade ago now. Yeah. It certainly was when we were fundraising. Yeah. And at the time, I didn't really know. I had put so much weight on that special success. Yeah. Right. It was, at the time, like the only hole in the fence I could see. Right? All right, that's my way out. Let me make this great thing, and then that'll get us. Yeah. And when it didn't, it was... Not just, I mean, a little demoralizing for sure, but a lot of things. Right. It shakes your confidence. It makes you not want to make something else immediately. Mm-hmm. And then over the course of the years, you learn that you can see these projects with ways to win, even if you don't win.
Right.
And you learn to put things in there that, okay, even if no one sees this, this is what I'm getting out of it. And if you do that in advance and you've done enough of these things to understand that one, you know, you're going to be let down in a lot of ways, most of which you can't even guess yet. There's so many ways a project can just kick you right in the balls. So you seed it with these ways to measure success along the way. And then when you get done with them all, each one should have propelled you a little bit further where when even if no one sees it, you're like, now I'm way better prepared to make this next thing in a way that you're almost happy they didn't see the thing you just made. You know, where you're like, if I could just remake this thing right now, knowing what I learned while I was making it. Mm-hmm. And when you sort of approach it that way, and then you realize your toolkit is getting fuller and fuller and fuller. Mm-hmm. And and you're making these decisions before the thing comes out, right? Yeah, when the Whiskey Brothers was happening, just in my head, it was this big deal, this better do well. But I didn't define any of the parameters of success. I couldn't have told you what would have made that a success. Right. Someone buying it, a million people seeing it. Like, I didn't even measure what would have made me happy. Now, it's kind of like, all right, if I do this in a vacuum, if I do this before everything, like the Chinese would say, you know, the three things you decide in advance, the rules, the stakes, and the quitting time.
Right.
For me, that's what this is. Mm-hmm. The signal noise is already a victory. It is already, to me, not behind me because I still have to promote it.
Sure.
But mentally, I'm writing the next hour. I'm about to start touring the next hour. Wow. I've kind of got the concepts in my head. Like, I've stepped away from this in a way that it's already shipped. It comes out on Tuesday, but I got rid of this thing a few weeks ago because I've seen it a million times and I've thought about it for a year and a half. And blood, sweat, and tears, and if I spend any more time in it, now I'm too attached and disappointed if it doesn't go the way I want it to. Instead of being the pro who's like, here's the car we made, driving off the lot, and someone put the next car in front of me.
Yeah, that's I mean, you've done a great progression that way in your discography. I mean, just the fact you've kind of been following, like you said earlier, the Louis C.K. plan a little, because he was the first guy coming out, doing his own specials, charging $10. I mean, brilliant, you know, cutting out the middle man and the upper man and every other man. Sell his thing for $10. You know, it was pretty,
He was him, and then he did Tignataro's special. And with those, you know, it was a proof that you could make money under a better model. I'll sell these for $5 or $10. Mm-hmm. We'll keep 100% of the money. Right. Louis has the reach to get that popularized. Mm-hmm. It was a good move.
Sure.
I look at it as, you know, the money be damned. Mm-hmm. What is the reach of a special? How do we take what we learned from Andy, right? Mm-hmm. How do we take what we learned from Jerry? How do we look at these different models and go, let's try this one. Let's say no to Comedy Dynamics. Let's say no to 800 Pound Gorilla. Let's say no to all the people offering us the same deal as everybody else.
Right.
And maybe we won't have to be the flavor of the week. Maybe we can spend a real year sinking into this thing. And maybe if the goal is eyeballs, right? Ask me if I'd pay what I spent on my special to have a million people see me do stand up, because I tell you right now, I'd pay 10 times that. It's an immense investment in myself as an advertiser. It's like an hour long infomercial of me doing what I do best.
I mean, I love YouTube. How could you not? It's the original free form, you know, anything goes. I mean, whoever, wouldn't you have liked to have had, you know, 1/1,000,000% of the original of the original taste, you know, if I could have just had a taste, but you know, that's the quintessential thing that somebody came up with, that as soon as it's discovered and spread, everybody says, why didn't I think of that? You know, YouTube.
And you'll look back and I'll look back at all of the emails I've sent and the messages I've sent and the reach outs and the this is and that's and the, you know, it's people don't know something's great until they're told it's great. We're just a weird culture like that. And it's not their fault. There's too much for any one person to process at this point. Yep. How could you be a purveyor of good taste? You got to trust someone to do it for you. So that's what this is. It'll get into the big current and it'll get out there. And I'm not really concerned about that. I think it stands on its own 2 feet.
Yeah, you sound like a person. And what is some of your reading stuff that you want to mention? Because you seem like a really well-read guy and a seeker, as I say.
I read a lot of nonfiction, obviously, a bunch of, books about business in some weird senses, because I don't have some odd MBA or something. You know, I didn't go to college. Mm-hmm. I'm now trying to navigate my way through a lot of this shit. Mm-hmm. So I'm always kind of looking at the way other industries do things, mm-hmm. not so much the way stand-up comedy does it, but like, what are the fundamentals of taking an idea from inception to reality? Right. And there's just a wealth out there. Right. I'd be totally lying if I tried to name some of the authors, but I've gone back and listened to, you know, the guy who wrote Getting to Yes or Getting to No or Getting Past No, he's a negotiator. Yeah, the guy who wrote Blue Ocean Strategy, the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. Like, those, I'm just scanning through.
Sounds like Harvey McKay or something, something of that ilk. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I also like Anthony DeMilo's, or DeMilo, however you pronounce any of these people. Awareness. Right. I read a bunch of stuff about consciousness. I'm looking at a book here called Soul Dust by this dude. Mm. But I've also got Godel Escher Bach's Eternal Golden Braids. I'm walking by my bookshelf while I'm talking to you. And then I read a lot of childish shit. I still love Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan and the old Treasure Island, like the greats, because it's storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love writers like Neil Gaiman. I love guys who get into that really deep fantasy world, who can take me somewhere and build characters and people that I've never seen before. Then I'm just as quick to throw that down and read old Stoic philosophy. And I'm saying all of that.
I love the Stoics. Love them.
If you're a stand-up comic or you're in entertainment adjacent and you're not, if you don't sit down with Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, what it teaches you about responding to external stimuli, which is what so many of us are up against, right? He says in the book, if you're distressed by anything external, your pain's not due to that thing, it's due to your perception of it. And when you stop down and you go, okay, man, what are all these things that have me so worked up, stressed about entertainment? I've got these kids coming up in TikTok. They're making these videos. They're deconstructing the industry I thought I worked in, and they're blah, 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 and all this stuff. And you stop and you go, wait, this is human beings still love great stories. They still love a certain arc. They like to be taken on a journey, and they like to feel certain emotions. And damn it, I understand how to craft and create and manipulate those emotions. So while I can sit here and get upset about this thing, the truth is, it's just me instantly responding in my reactionary way. If I stop and sit back and go, all right, man, why don't you stop that and really dissect what the problem is? And the problem is just the landscape. You just don't understand it. Right. If you stop and ask for directions and got a map and were willing to spend some time in it instead of bitching about it, you might realize that it's not even a problem. It's kind of created a void of the stuff that you're good at making.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, they've literally chased all the long form people into short form. When I see big thinkers, when I see people like Steven Pinker and Tim Ferriss or podcast hosts that are good interviewers and good people constantly breaking their content down into smaller and smaller chunks, and you're like, this is supposed to be a 3-hour conversation, not a jump cut, clickbait, so. When those people are going that route, it really makes me want to stop and kind of knuckle up and go, wait, where's everybody not going right now? Because I bet there's still audience there. And that's where a lot of the stoicism comes in. It just teaches you to be very present, less reactionary, and, you know, more willing to work with what you have instead of lamenting what you don't.
Yeah, when I read some of the Marcus Aurelius and a lot of the Stoics, you always go, how were these guys so hip? You always think of so many thousand years ago. These guys had it, and they got their robes they're wearing and their cool hair. These guys, they've got it all figured out, and they didn't even have TV or satellite television or TikTok, and they were already up against the same, you know.
That's what you realize, that nothing changes. Same problems in a different medium. It was just as noisy then comparatively, you know?
You can look at a newscast from, you know, the 1970s and 1960s, where they were talking about war, and they were talking about demonstrations, they were talking about the jobless thing. So, you know, you go back, you know, it's like, It's more intense now because we're living in it and there's 8 billion people on the planet, but it was just as intense, you know, at that time.
When you look back at movies like Network, if you remember that fantastic monologue and how you could replay it right now.
Right.
And it would be exactly
I'm
the
as
same.
Mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I like how he cut off the more. Take it anymore.
When you look at stuff like that and you look at how it's relative to the ecosystem at the time, right? Now, the pressure and the tension is ratcheted up to 11 on a global scale. But it's no different than having the tension ratcheted up to 11 on a municipal scale or on a national scale or on a domestic scale. Right? You can have the same level of unhappiness and tension we feel globally in your living room with your family. So when I think of those people in the 60s or 70s, the whole aquarium they lived in was full of the same tension and the same, you know? So now it's just kind of pervasive in it because it's everywhere.
Yeah, because I remember you saying, we had texted back and forth, and you said, I haven't watched the news in probably 20 years. It's just not something that's part of my daily purview. I know it's there, you know, And a lot of people will say, you're not a good citizen, all this stuff. Believe me, you catch of it, enough of it on the periphery, and, you know, it's always wafting through. It's not like I never see a channel of it here, a channel of it there. But I refuse to watch something that's already been predisposed to try to bullshit me.
if you understand that what you're about to see has been edited and turned into a product, that's fine. You watch it for entertainment, that's fine. But the disinterest for me, right, comes from the fact that I think we're all, how can I phrase it, care atheists to an extent. We all don't care about certain things, right? And it's not because you don't care about them. You're simply unaware of them. They're not inside of your circle, right? There are problems right now happening in Darfur that no one woke up this morning thinking about, right? There are people who, when a concert gets shot up in France, they go nuts and they got to change their photo and, we got to handle this. But when a concert gets shot up in Russia, no one even blinks. 129 people dead, and it doesn't even, no one's like, oh, those poor souls. Because you care about what matters to you. You care about what's close to you. Yeah. And if I turn off the news, it doesn't make me a bad citizen. It just means I don't care about maybe two or three less things than you. That's it.
Yeah.
It's not like I don't care. I just don't care about the things that I can't daily impact.
Exactly. Sadly, that's why the car chases became such a big thing, because they found out they were a ratings boost. You know, they're not, and it's so funny how the TV just sell their soul right down the river.
we're not all incentivized by the same things, and that's what's bad about it, right? Yeah. When the media is, when you're trying to fill in different cells on a spreadsheet than each other, and every time I change mine, it fucks up your numbers. It's where I'm like, I want quality and information, and they go, well, every time we do that, this number with the dollar sign and it goes down. So and you really have to be cognizant of what you put in your brain, because we're ultimately the combination of just a very small handful of inputs, and they overlap and turn us into who we are.
What
and
would the Stoics say? The Stoics would say, do not watch the news. They would not be news people.
You don't have any control over it.
Yeah. So, you had another TV thing, Just the Bit. It was something that you exec produced, right? Just the Bit?
We shot a pilot for a show. It's the same director for my special and my director of photography. Two guys, Adam Taylor and Rob Nielsen, who we've worked on many projects together. Mm-hmm. They helped me. They were literally instrumental in the creative team with me on Andy Huggins as well.
Cool.
And when we met, ironically, and not ironically, coincidentally, whatever the word is, Jordan Brady introduced me to Adam.
Wow.
And way back after we got back from Afghanistan, I was so intrigued by film and storytelling and was trying to do some cool things. And I was auditioning for this Discovery Channel show that was kind of an outdoor adventure show. And I had shot a bunch of stuff for it, but I didn't know how to edit it.
Okay.
And I naively reached out to Jordan and said, hey, what can I do here? Here's what I got, and I don't know what to do. Can you help me edit it? Like, that's how naive I was about editing.
All right.
And Jordan takes it, and a day later, he sends me back a finished piece.
Oh, my God.
And I realized I just got this magnificent director, right? This dude with these crazy credits and all this fun stuff. He just edited it for me.
Oh, my God.
And much later on, I realized the magnitude of what he had done.
And how long was the piece? How long was the piece?
It was like a 5-minute audition.
Oh, okay. He probably did it on Final Cut Pro, you know.
Of course. It was audio mixed. Yeah. It had a music bed. Man. I mean, he produced, he put a spot together.
It was a sizzle reel, baby.
Yes, yes. And way outside of his. Like, if someone called me and asked me to do that for them, I would tell them no. And I'm not anywhere on his list. So when I got back from that trip and I had asked him about that and I was talking about some other stuff, and he goes, you know who you should meet? He goes, I got a film guy down in Houston who does a bunch of commercial work, and he's taking my directing boot camp. And he goes, you should meet him. And he set me up with Adam. And we've made amazing things since. Just the Bit was a concept that Adam and Rob had that takes stand-up comedy and basically allows the comic to not perform the bit in front of a live crowd, but to sort of verbally say it to the camera while the bit is happening in live action around them. There's something that similarly came out after we started called Laugh Tracks that this is very different than that, because we're not playing the audio and there's no crowd laughter. There's a lot of differences.
Yeah.
It is kind of, and the way I happily defend it, back in 2005, I made a film with Tom Hester and Tom Rhodes and Paul Provenza was attached. Oh, we made a short film called Fistful of Pills. Oh, and
I watched a little bit of that. That's the one where the actor guys are all sped up and they're mouthing whatever the comic was saying on stage. Right? I watched just a little bit of that because I'm always up for a good mushroom short film. And it was actually very funny. You know, I think I forgot how long is this, like a half hour, 20 minutes, or just 5 minutes?
It's like 12 to 15 minutes.
I watched the one that was on your, I just downloaded it from whatever the link was. I thought it was very funny because I like stuff that moves fast and it's surreal like that. And you could barely see the guys lip syncing the guy's act. Was it Hester doing the comedy?
So let me tell you the story behind this film. We, in 2005, this might have been four. We took it to Just for Laughs in 2005. Oh, cool. So this might have been 2004. Mm-hmm. Tom Hester calls me. Hey man, I got this joke. Tom's a fantastic comic. Hey man, I got this bit, man. You know, Fistful of Pills, man. He goes, I want to shoot it. I want to fucking shoot it. Let's just do it. I'm like, Tom, I've never shot anything in my life. Mm-hmm. And Tom had not gone. Now he's gone to film school and a bunch of other stuff. We're in the same ignorant boat. So I go, all right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to take $800. I'm going to go down to Best Buy. I'm going to buy a 3-chip digital camcorder or a mini. It was a mini DV tape, whatever those tapes are.
I had one of those. Yeah.
I go, all right, we're going to take this and everybody's going to learn their lines. Tom Rhodes is in this weekend. Mm. You drive in from Austin. We'll get another couple of comics to act. Right. And everybody learns their lines and we'll all play it. I'll play it over the speaker. We'll all lip sync it. Yeah. And then we'll figure out how to put this together. Yeah. So everybody shows up. We're all hammered. We've been drinking till 3-4 o'clock that night. I mean, it's the next day. Nobody in the room knows their lines.
Oh, geez.
The actor, the actual actor. So we start trying to do this and it's just a mess. Mm. And I go, okay. I go, this thing has some functions on it. Mm-hmm. I go, if I press this button, it makes everything really trippy. I go, what if we shoot it like that? Yeah. I go, and then no one will really be able to tell we're not saying the right line.
Right. Every ventriloquist should use that app. That's the first thing I know. Every once in a while, you'll catch a guy where the mouth is kind of syncing up. But you don't want to have that detour from the essence of the video anyway. It was better.
Right.
They're moving their heads. They're sitting on the couch.
Jittery, jumpy, the lights blur, all that stuff. Right. So we took all of that. Right. And then Tom goes, all right, none of us have the ability to put this shit together. He goes, but But Tom goes, I know Emery. Emery was editing at the time.
Right, the aristocrats, right.
He agreed to edit it.
Right.
He takes everything that was sent. Tom shot some B-roll. He sends it in. And then Paul Provenza, who was also doing the aristocrats at the time with Penny, was willing to put his name on it as a creative consultant. And Tom let him pick the font. That was what Paul did.
Did he associate producer?
Basically. So we put him on as creative consultant, and that with the end credit that was dedicated to Mitch Hedberg, and the whole we took it to Montreal. We had a wonderful time with it, but it was just this comedy of errors in trying to create something. You just had a bunch of creative people in a room who didn't know what they were doing at all. Mm-hmm. You had people who were as inexperienced as I was at the time in my fourth or fifth years of stand-up. Mm-hmm. I'd never made a film. I didn't, like, nothing, right? Cool. So I'm the young guy. And then you've got Tom Rhodes, who's had a sitcom on the other side of the table, and everybody in between there. And just being in a room on a Saturday trying to figure out how to make something is still one of the most, it's one of my favorite emotions. I know it's like one of the best feelings I know how to feel.
I've always said making a video. I first went in when I was a senior in high school. You know, it was before movable type, but somehow they had a video room. Of course, I didn't find out about it till the last 2 months of my goddamn senior year. But I remember walking into that room and they had these huge ass, like, network-sized cameras. I said, this is the most fun I could ever have in life. And to this day, I've been making videos for 40 years, you know, with my students I made them, with my friends. We used to, before we did stand-up, we had a group called the Spudniks. You know, we just made stuff for local access cable. But there is no funner thing in the world than filmmaking and that creative process, because it's just pure joy to me, you know.
Well, when you understand how all the toys in a room work, it's a much more fun room to play in. And I've been the guy in the room who comes in for a thing and I don't understand anything around me and I don't know how it works, and I'm just waiting for someone to tell me what to do and hope that I do it well. And that to me is, there's no magic in that. You know, where you're sitting there waiting on someone else to yell. Action to me, if you understand, like I said, man, if you're into the guts and you got it all down, you suddenly come in and it's like walking into this huge workshop of, wait, I know how to use the drill press and the saw and the CNC machine and the printer. And you go, with that, I could build a rocket ship versus the guy who has to go sit in the little chair until someone who knows how to run all the equipment comes in and goes, well, here's what we're going to make today. We're all going to make a clock shaped like Texas. And you're like, we're making cutting boards? I'm not here to make cutting boards.
I know, exactly. It's like school. Everybody work in groups. You know, everything is cookie cutter. Yeah. They force you to do stuff.
So. I remember lessons and classes. You know, I remember being in home ec even in middle school and stuff, where you're where you're being tasked, you're given a pattern, and we made boxer shorts or something, you know, like a stupid home ec problem where you're sewing and you're supposed to be following the pattern. But I remember being completely perplexed the whole process, right? Whatever we were supposed to be making, be damned. I was so intrigued by how the needle of the sewing machine worked. I couldn't wrap my dumb middle school brain around that. So I was drawing stitched lines in places they shouldn't go. And when it was done, I was like, oh, wait, I kind of think I know how I sew it. This is fascinating. I don't have any boxer shorts, ma'am. I'm so sorry. But today I learned how things work. And that's so much cooler.
The kid who really was the kid that I was always interested in was, and reading and researching and doing this all my life, is the kid that wanted to take the radio apart when he was a kid, because he wanted to see what the hell made it work. And those are the people like what you are. Those are the people that actually make something of themselves, because they're not doing what the chosen leaders are telling you to do. You know, I was always, always been a nonconformist that way. I don't want to do what this person is, you know.
But it's more than even being nonconformist to me. If I'm doing what's truly interesting to me, then it takes the pressure of the outcome off. It's back to what we were saying, is you're building in these sort of secret ways to win, even if you lose. You can get to a point where you're like, okay, man, I made this. No one saw it. It didn't do what mm-hmm. I wanted it to do. Yeah. But why don't you sit in how fun it was to make that, right? Mm-hmm. Like where you had to go to shoot it, the experience you got while you were doing it, the the stories that came along with that. And suddenly it's not really, I don't have to, something doesn't have to be successful in that regard for me to take the experience and then turn it into stand-up or turn it into a book chapter. You're kind of like, once you know all the things at your disposal, when you deeply understand them, nothing's really a failure because it's this other cool thing that you get to pull from later. And as long as you're being very intentional about what you choose to do, ideally everything you do adds to what you already have. There's no way I'd say yes to doing, if someone asked me right now to direct or shoot some three-camera club shoot like we did for Jerry, I would say no. Because there's nothing to be gained from that for me but money. And okay, great, you can pay me, but now I've got to spend 6 months or a year, however long of my life, doing this thing.
Right.
I've got to do the thing that, if it doesn't do the main thing I need it to do, still covers all those secondary bases, like makes my curiosity happy.
And it's cool. It's a testament to you that you did the specials for Andy and for Jerry Wayne before you did kind of your baby. And, you know, you could say, well, I was learning on them, but, you know, the Andy Huggins seemed like it was a labor of love. And the interviews I've seen you in, because you seem like you, you know, you truly have an affection for the guy and for his work, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm a fan of Andy. That's the cool part with that project was like, I had kind of decided, because not only did I get to, when we did the fundraising for Andy's project, I put a significant amount of money up front into the Kickstarter video and originally was thinking about using some of it for the intro, but I brought in some of the old Outlaws. So I had Jimmy Pineapple and Keyshawn Shannon and Tracy Wright, and then the owner of the old Comedy Workshop, Paul Menzel. Brought all of them into the foundation room at the House of Blues, which is a stunning room here in Houston. And we the full rig, I had a, you know, we had it all in there, and we shot them in an interview talking about Andy and talking about those old days. So I was sitting back as just a fan of comedy, a guy who remembers seeing Pineapple in the suit, you know, and before I ever told a joke. And it was magic to interview them and ask them about this and hear them tell the stories. And those are the things that you just go, man, it's, who cares if you know I'm attached? Look what I'm getting to do. Yeah, like I'm driving this boat right now, and I just can't believe how fun it is.
That is so great. That is really neat. Okay, so the special Signal Noise premieres April 2nd on YouTube. Any more little doodads or trinkets you want to add to that? I mean, I can see how you'd be. It's like having a book come out. It's, you're having a movie come out. I mean, it's, I know you said you're already working on your next hour, but it's, what's the excitement level on it?
Well, on the new hour or the one that's coming out?
Yeah, the one that's coming out.
It's such a, my excitement, it's just staying at an 11. It hasn't left an 11. Every day that gets closer.
That's great.
Because you, it's really weird. Like right now, everything is hypothetical. Everything is theoretical. Is it going to get seen? Are people going to dig it? Is it going to, well, who knows? And it's the, and I would tell you, man, based on everything I know about entertainment, that two things. One, this could come out and a million people could watch it by day two. And if they did, I would look at you and I would say, I never had a doubt that that's what was going to happen. I also could release it. And a month later, 16 people might have seen it. And I would also look at you and tell you that I never had a doubt that was how it was going to end up. Because there's just no predicting it. So for me, the closer the release date gets, the happier I get, because I'll finally have actionable data, right? Here's what this is. I can show it to people and not have, like right now, there's a lot of folks I can't really send it to because you only get one shot, right? Some of my bigger celebrity friends, I don't want to message them and go, hey, there's this thing that comes out in nine days. Can you just rather hit them when it's out and flash mob it. So that's where the excitement level is really just in this cool pocket of unknownness. And I think even really after it comes out, even if it goes one of those two ways, right? Nobody sees it. I'm going to look back and go, man, wouldn't you give $1 million to be back in that position where you just didn't know and the excitement was still there? Mm-hmm. And also, when there's if 1 million people do see it, there's still going to be a little bit of a loss there where you're like, there's still no longer the unknown.
Yeah.
Now it's out there and I'm doing different things. So I'm trying to be present and sit in this particular week's worth of.
And that's not easy for a guy who describes that the log jam and the brain's always going.
That, which is why you have to write the next special. Like I started writing this as soon as we had as soon as I knew when this was coming out and I had put some better pieces together, I immediately called the improv and booked the date. I booked it in January this past year and just committed to, I'm going to go do a new hour. It could suck. It could be great, but it's going to be nothing off the special. And because I have to get the wheels turning and figure out what I'm supposed to be talking about now.
What's the, all the countries you've been to? I mean, you must have. Do you have a fair amount of contact still with a lot of the people that you've met in other countries?
I stay in touch with one of my, I would probably tell you my superpower if I have one, that you could push me out of a plane anywhere in the world and short of Siberia or Mongolia, I think within 3 hours I could be somewhere safe. Like there's probably, I just know people in different pockets. And a lot of this has been military, but a lot of this has just been, yeah, I've got friends in Japan that I could, I could fly in tomorrow and show up on their doorstep and dinner, we'd have dinner tonight and would hang out for the week and there would be no questions asked. I have friends in Italy that I can do. There are people that I've met that remain friends. I may never see them again, but we talk and we touch base and we, it reminds me, I'd like to remind myself how common everybody really is. Oh, you're dealing with the same shit. I was able to talk to them through the pandemic. It was fascinating to have friends in all these countries where it's being handled differently or it's being, you know, done like this and trying to talk through the differences. Okay, wait. So wait, nobody's thinking this. Everybody's thinking this. Wow, over here it's this.
Right.
And just that ability gives it's I have a really good friend in Portugal who is a stand-up comic also and it's neat to he'll message me sometimes with a point of view that is him kind of working out a joke but it's letting me see where the funny in this topic is for a guy from Lisbon I don't think with Lisbon filters he does I see what you're seeing this adds to my arsenal of what I can talk about so that's where my friends everywhere come in handy is just being able to you know talk about different subjects and hear a different point of view that I'm not going to get at the bar up the street.
Were your USO tours and all your tours with the military, were those a lot of the reason why you hit 60 countries, would you say, is based on that kind of? And you, certainly. So you started, when did you first do your first, like, overseas military tour in the early 2000s?
I went in October of 2001.
Wow.
So I was less than 30 days removed from 9/11.
Ooh.
And I went to Germany. And we played Rammstein and Simbach. And at the time, I was, what was I in 2001? 23, maybe.
Wow.
I was this Southeast Texas kid. I'd never been anywhere. Like nowhere. The Gulf Coast, I had probably like four states, I think. And I was in a miserably abusive relationship. Like it was one of the worst, I mean, it was a terrible situation. And I was just I would say yes to anything, anywhere. And I was so far down on the list of comics to go with this one company. And then 9/11 happened. And everybody bailed.
Okay.
Wow. Just like a house of cards. And I was, they got to me and I got the message and the phone call and the, do you want to go? And I said, yes. And for someone who'd never been anywhere, this naive Texas kid who was, and I was an ugly American. Like I thank God there's no footage of all that. I was so ignorant and so Texan and so loud and so brash, but it sparked something. And I remember sitting there having beers with these kids who couldn't have been older than 18, 19 years old.
Right.
And all of them had signed up for the military to pay for college. There was no war. They were all just little Southern kids who wanted to get college paid for. And they signed up in 2000 or whatever it was. And now I'm, you know, you're sitting here having beers with them and we're at war. And their kids are flying missions the next day, you know, they're load masters, having to drop relief supplies, whatever. And they're telling you stories about this and that. And it was just, as Americans, we didn't know anything. Right. And all of it was overwhelming. And I remember coming back going, okay, I don't know really what just happened. The shows were terrible. I was, the soldiers who saw us deserved Purple Hearts. It was that bad. Like, give these guys a commendation for
But you gotta, your first time on stage is bad enough, but your first time on a stage during a war on a USO tour, that, and you were still, like you said, you were still kind of a young comic. So
green and dirty and I didn't have, I just didn't have the arsenal of material you need in a setting like that. I was doing 30 minutes and I might have had 25 and 15 of that wasn't even designed for heat. It was a weird scrambly dog paddle to stay above the surface.
But sometimes that immersion, that full immersion, because how long after that was it that you did your second one? Was it?
I didn't go. It wasn't that long at all. I think it was 2002 that I went to Japan almost immediately afterwards. Yep. And I went out there infinitely more prepared.
Sure.
I now knew what the job was. I knew the place I had to survive. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't this open mic stage I was used to at the Laugh Stop. Mm-hmm. That was a different fight.
But and didn't that make you a much more, you know, not only better, but every tour you went on, you had a wider breadth of understanding that the world was a pretty big place.
in two regards, you get to see the world itself. Right. You get to see all these different countries, and you see the third country nationals working on base, and you see the country itself as you get out. Oftentimes, we're staying off base and getting to explore. But you're also getting to play for a weird amalgamation of Americans that you don't normally get.
Right.
Because while the military is made up of a lot of people from Texas and North Carolina, you also have, you know, you'll play a certain little spot and it'll be a unit, right, out of a certain place. So everybody there might be from Arkansas, or all these folks might be from Wisconsin, and you suddenly learn what's the common language? Mm-hmm. What material works for all these people?
Right.
And what material works only for these people? And then you build this arsenal of, all right, here's all the stuff that here's all the general artillery. And then here's the very specific. And my God, I got a room full of X. Well, I have all these X jokes. That's the, by the time you're, I think I'm 44 tours. We were trying to count the other day, but whatever it's been, by the time you've done all those, there's just, you're not afraid of any group of people.
I think you did more than Bob Hope did.
It's funny. I don't know how many he did, but there's a comic by the name of Scott Kennedy who got.
I remember. I worked with him.
Nine years ago or so.
Yeah, he was from Texas, right?
He was a Houston guy. Yeah. And he did, I saw his obituary the other day because of another project that I'm attached. It was for an interesting reason. And when I looked at it, he had done 50 tours. And I went, you know what, man? That's the, if there's anybody on the planet who did have more, it was Scott. And, you know, I can't tell you that we're going to finish with me below him, but for the moment, that's the one guy who did do more for sure. And I remember being so inspired by him too, back in the late 2000s. You know, he was leading a tour a month into Iraq. I was working directly with General Petraeus and some really cool stories from his side of the table that I just remember going, man, that's, I'm an adventurer. This is who I am at my soul. You telling me if I have the choice between playing Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the basement of a strip club on a Friday night, or getting on a Black Hawk helicopter and being flown through the desert at night to do shows for guys who might be dead tomorrow. Like, when you really put it down like that, like, it wasn't even a question for me. That's how I spent, as soon as I got in with Armed Forces Entertainment, after all the individual shows through the 2000s, I spent the decade of whatever the 2000 teens were. There was no goal. The goal quit being television. The goal quit being Tonight Show. The goal quit being acting. Mm-hmm. I realized I don't want to do any of this. Hmm. I want to go out there and play, man. I want to do what I'm good at for people who need it. Hmm. And all along the way, I want to fill my eyeballs and ear holes and heart and soul with all this shit I've never seen before.
That's great.
And you're telling me right now that's possible? Well, here we go. It leaves you. It leaves you. Like, I realized this even through the pandemic when I dropped off of social media for my own sanity.
Yeah.
That when you take your eye off a ball, right? When you stop covering a certain square, when you stop focusing on a thing, it goes away. It's you. When I turned my head away from social media to focus on the stuff I was focused on, what fell apart were all of these fragile connections I had with certain people and some of these clubs and bookers and comics and things that were so temporary and tenuous. If we didn't talk every day, then I wasn't really in your circle because I'm not helping you or doing it. So when all that stuff kind of happens, which is what happened to me in all of those 20 teens, when I put myself out there to focus on all of that, you have to take your eye off of some other things. So that's when I realized, all right, man, I'm not necessarily in the conversations that they're having for Netflix's a joke, or I'm not in the conversations they're having for this festival. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm not worthy or because I'm not good enough, because I'm not talking to these people. I'm out here trying to see what the middle of Ethiopia looks like. And now I'm in that place where it's like, okay, let's look at the spaces we haven't paid a lot of attention and figure out which ones we want to play in, because we're just having fun right now.
You're an inspiration. What's that picture on your website where you're wearing the mask where it looks like you're Lawrence of Arabia? Where are you there? Where were you?
That one actually is in Chile. I am down at Torres del Paine, and I was there in November. I went and hiked it and El Chaltén, which are two crazy cool mountains.
What country is that in?
So in Chile, it's called the Carretera.
Oh, wasn't it near Patagonia? Or?
It is. So Patagonia is the southern part of South America, and it covers a lot of Chile and Argentina. Mm-hmm. And if you rent a car, you can drive down from Santiago to a place called Portmont, and you can take a ferry. And that road runs about 3,000 kilometers from Santiago down to the very edge, which is at the end of the world. And we drove that whole road over the course of 2 weeks, stopping and hiking and camping and doing just amazing things. And what I'm wearing there is called, I think, a smog. And I got it in Afghanistan.
Cool.
And it is the most versatile head wrap. It is a head wrap. It is a face mask. It is a neck warmer. And I have just dragged that thing all over the world with me. And it just was very windy and blustery that day.
Yes, because my cousin just did the tour where they went through. They were in Chile, Patagonia, and then they went to the South Pole to see the penguins. I don't know if you...
Yeah, so they stage out of that's basically the very bottom tip of Chile is where they stage out of for Antarctica, either there or I think you can get there from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But it's following that road down there and being down at that there is nothing like that part of the world. That's where Darwin and the Beagles sailed around that tip. In fact, Mount Fitzroy there at El Chaltén is named after the captain of the Beagle. But when you listen to tales of that era and that journey around that southern tip and the Patagonian people and the indigenous life there and that place, once you get there, you realize has almost not changed at all.
Mm-hmm.
The roads are still unpaved. The civilization is still wood stove. Wow. It is a very, it's the wildest place I've been in a while.
Mm. Yeah, that is great. I know I saw they got no global warming going on down there. That's for sure. No global warming. Hey, so give your book a quick plug. We're going to wrap it up here, but I want to just the book, and then you got another one coming up, but I can have you back on and we can talk about your next hour and all that stuff. But the name of your book is Until All the Dragons Are Dead.
The Dragons Are Dead.
And you said the artwork was done by...
I recognize when I put this book out, this was another learning process, right? Mm-hmm. There were some little imprints that we were talking to and some things. And I decided the way we were going to do it, I was going to hire everybody and get it all done myself. So when I talked to a designer and we talked about a bunch of different things for the cover. Mm-hmm. And she sent back a few things I wasn't thrilled with. Mm-hmm. And then this one that had this plate she found in some 18th century book. And it was of this Peter Pan looking character, mm-hmm, standing, mm-hmm, on top, mm-hmm, of a dead Hydra. And it's black and white line art. Mm-hmm. And it matched the tone and the feel of what I was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. And the, mm-hmm, colors matched. It just was so perfect. And we licensed it. And that's the cover of the book.
Wow.
But the book is a series of its stories from all over the road. Right. And, you know, it's a comics, mm-hmm, perspective of probably the first decade's worth of touring, wow, of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun stuff. I'm excited for the, mm-hmm, second one just because, right, I am a demonstrably better writer, right, than I was with the first one. But the first one is done, mm-hmm, really, really well. Huh. It's not a difficult read. Okay. It's probably 260 pages, but I'm not writing to show off like, right, oh, I'm smarter than you. Mm-hmm. I'm writing because I think there's some fun stories in there. And, right, if you read it with that heart, I think, right, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I read the reviews, a lot of reviews, and they all say the same thing, what a fun read it is. And it's an easy read, but it's a fun read. And so you weren't really, I mean, you were on the road for a fair amount of time, like doing the clubs across the country, but does the book deal with some of that and some of the military tours, or one more than, yeah, the other?
It covers both. Yeah. I was still a young comic, so, mm-hmm, there's less philosophical me in this, I, mm-hmm, think. There's less, okay, pondering. It's more what happened. They're, yeah, fun stories. I, mm-hmm, talk about, mm-hmm, you know, there's stuff that happens. We were in Austin one night with a group of us doing a Whiskey Brothers show, and we ended up stealing the mascot from this bar that was a 8-foot-tall Jamaican banana.
Oh my God.
And it was the Ocean's 11 level heist that we pulled involved, mm-hmm, distracting bartenders and regular patrons and moving a car around, yeah, and moving an actual, you know, so it's, there's some fun stories in there that I approach, uh-huh, as that story is the vehicle for me saying a lot of other things and kind, mm-hmm, of point. It's fun. Yeah. It's a lot of that, but then there's also Iraq and there's also, mm-hmm, you, mm-hmm, know, some fun, mm-hmm, cool, some fun places you probably haven't been.
Right. All right. Well, we got about 90 minutes in here, brother. And I knew, and we didn't do much pre-interview, but I've been a fan and I continue to be a fan. And and the same thing happened with me, kind of, that what happened with Andy Huggins when he said, hey, how do you do shoot a special one? And, you know, I've just taped a few of these things, even though I've, you know, been planning it for a while. And when I saw your thing on Facebook the other day, he goes, put me on your podcast. So that night I said, when do you want to be on? Because I'm a fan and I like the fact that you've, you know, you're a seeker and you're doing it your own way, which is a different way, because that's the way it should be. Everybody's way should be their own way, but you've really kind of set the bar pretty high.
It helps me sleep at night, which is always the number one motivation behind, yeah, my decision.
Wow. And one last thing, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but that's your real name, right? Slade Ham. It's a cool ass name. I mean,
they just give it to you on your birthday. My mom said, uh-huh, no, it's my middle name, but I've never, okay, gone by anything else. Right. If you yelled my first name out, I wouldn't notice. Mom tells the story as, uh-huh, she was being wheeled down the hallway to give, uh-huh, birth. My grandmother followed her down the hospital hall, going, you can't name him Slade. He'll grow up to be a merciless gunslinger. And, you know, granted, my grandmother, yeah, was born in 1901, so there, wow, were probably some merciless gunslingers back in the day. But, wow, the one thing that was for sure, yeah, right, was that I wasn't going to be a cubicle guy, yeah, with that, right, name. And thank, mercifully, God, names, thank, mean, God, things, yeah, and I'm very grateful for mine.
I mean, it's a, like I said, I was born Richard, and I was going to write an article once. I used to be a Dick, but now I'm Rich. I went by Dickie and Dick my whole my whole so when I go home, you know how it is, when you go home, all my friends from high school still call me Dick, and all my the relatives who are half senile, the ones that are left, you know, of course they say, Dickie, come over with the cranberry sauce. And that's cool because that's my hometown, I expect that. But in fact, the year I got into comedy, 1982, I said, I think I'm going to go with Rich Stein. I'm sick of Dick Steins. And wouldn't you know it, then Richard became a term synonymous with is what a dick always was before that. That guy's a real Richard. At least I picked Rich. But all right, well, I'm a nonconformist because most people would ask, what's with the name Slade Ham at the beginning? But I decided to throw it on at the end. That's the kind of guy I am.
Make them wonder.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to Signal Noise on April 2nd and all your future adventures. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Rich.
All righty.